if you allow yourself to be knowable without trying to change the other person, you open up the possibility of really increasing the intelligence in the couple, being more able to see what you don't see, being more able to see the wisdom that the other person has, as well as having your own wisdom be in that conversation. Collaborative couples are able to bring the best in themselves and the best in their perspectives to solve things, to create solutions.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
I'm going to be talking about mixed faith marriages and the challenges that are a part of this. First thing I would say is that this is not easy stuff. So much of our comfort is being around people. This is kind of tribalism and kind of how we instinctively function, is we like to be around people who think like we do. We like the comfort of it, the reinforcement of it, the sense of security that comes from it. I remember watching a 60 Minutes interview where there was research done on babies as young as 4 months, looking at this basic tendency we have to prefer people who think like us and to reject people who don't. And even in these cute little babies, they were little bigots. Okay, so when the teddy bear would actually help another teddy bear in trouble, the baby liked that teddy bear more. Okay, so they liked the teddy bear who was helpful. So we have our pro-social tendencies. But if the child preferred Fruit Loops, if the teddy bear liked Cheerios and liked something different than the child was more rejecting of the teddy bear and was okay even with the teddy bear being harmed by another teddy bear, okay? So you see our sadism even. We like to find people that agree with us. All of us do. And that's why it's easy to watch news channels that reinforce what we already think, and to have scorn towards people who think differently. And it's crazy, we live in a world where you can turn on the news to get the view you like. That's part of our deep problem, as opposed to when I was growing up, you had 3 channels. They all covered basically the same events, maybe had slightly different angles, but it wasn't about opinion and reinforcement of your ideas. It was more about the facts, and you sorted out what you thought about it. This ability to get in these echo chambers is a big, big challenge to our democracy. When it's happening right on the home front, it's super stressful. And something valuable that's happening, even though it doesn't feel good, is it's driving at least the question of who am I? What do we believe? What do I believe? That something that was taken as a given or an assumption between you is now being called up into question. And that's not easy. It is, in fact, the process of differentiation. You have to define who you are. And now more than ever, when you can't get the validation of your spouse or perhaps your family or your group. So this person writes, I've been really reevaluating my faith recently, and I'm curious if anyone has had a similar experience. And if you have any tips on how to navigate this with a spouse, did you talk openly with your spouse? Did you keep your faith journey to yourself? I'd love any tips on how to handle our relationship during this really stressful time. I feel alone, but I don't necessarily want to cause him pain by sharing my thoughts with him. So again, this is disruptive. There's no question about it. And the question that's coming up here is how much intimacy can the marriage handle? And if you share honestly what you think and feel, it's going to disrupt your spouse's view of you and perhaps their view of the world. And that's different than hurting your spouse, right? You don't want to cause pain, and it may cause some pain, okay? But that's different than causing harm to your spouse. To know you doesn't cause anyone harm. It may cause them disappointment. It may cause them anxiety. It may mean they have to sort out what they think and feel or feel more alone. But that's different than knowing you is to be destructive, okay? As long as it's based in something that's honest and sincere. Because if it's coming from an honest place, then it's part of creating an intimate marriage. And, you know, like you've probably heard me say, intimate marriages are a nice idea, but very few of us actually want them when intimate means knowing your spouse who thinks differently than you do or wants different things or wants the marriage to grow in specific ways that are outside of your comfort zone or what you want. So intimacy is not about reinforcement. It's about the tolerance of knowing and being known. And a faith crisis is sticking the thumb right into the center of that question of if a couple's in a split understanding. So it's going to be stressful. You have to plan on that. And you no longer are going to have the easy validation of the community, because you may also, in addition to not having the easy validation of your spouse, you may look like an impaired couple to some people. And so you're going to have to let go of a validation that you once knew. And that's fundamental to growth, but it never feels good. So again, you're going to be figuring out who you are, and you're going to be up against questions that are difficult. Am I doing something destructive? Am I blind to myself? Am I blind to what I believe in? Am I doing something that's hurting my spouse? And those kinds of questions are uncomfortable. And it's very easy during that time, and I see a lot of people do this, that they go outside of the marriage to get reinforcement from other people. So the believing spouse goes and tells his or her bishop or friends, and they get an easy kind of reinforcement of, you poor thing, how do you put up with it? You know, on some level, you get it, your spouse doesn't, and that can feel helpful in a way, and it can make you feel secure, I suppose. But it's not good for creating an actual marriage where you need that tension to stay in the marriage to work itself out. Or if you're a disbelieving spouse, you can go to an online group or a friend and get the eye rolls from them around the believing spouse and feel reinforced in the superiority of your view. And it's very easy to do it. Now, I'm not saying you never can go to a third party in the face of marital distress. You just want to know that going to that third party is facilitating your ability to deal with your marriage, not diffusing the attention so that you don't deal with or work to reconcile or come to a shared enough understanding where you're creating a space for two people, right? This is the goal of marriage, is to create a home for two, that you can be true to who you are and make room for who the other person is. And, you know, if we want the idea that we're going to marry someone who thinks just like us, reinforces the world just like we see it, first of all, if we happen to get that, we're going to be bored, not that attracted to them. And also not get pressured in good ways, where when you marry somebody different than you, as I talk about, it's a kind of soul developing mechanism, because it pressures you to sort out who you are, to figure out what it really means to love another person. Most of us marry to kind of find somebody to reinforce us and make us feel like how we see things is ideal or good enough or we're ideal or whatever, rather than really making room for another human being. So to the person's question of how do you handle it, what I would say is you want to speak about yourself as honestly as you can, but not pressure, in this case, him, to reinforce you. It's going to be easy to want the other person to see things as you see them. It's just natural. Like, come on. And especially if you're the disbelieving spouse, because you can feel like my whole family, all of my church community, they all see it one way, and I see it differently now. And it scares me, but it also is important to me that you understand it. And while I think it's natural to want to be understood or known, you have to be careful that you don't turn that into, you should see it like I see it. That's our tendency, is the control in that sort of demand for reinforcement. Going and pressuring, though, that's when we go across our boundary and we start trying to get other people to manage us. Now, this is very human, very understandable, but it interferes with creating a marriage and it interferes with intimacy. And so if you're though going to share who you are, you're staying on your side of the line, but you're letting yourself be knowable. So you could say, I'm struggling to believe this idea in the old way, right? And this is why I can't or I don't see it in the same way as I used to, because of A, B, and C reasons. And so it no longer resonates with me. But again, you're showing yourself, your mind. You're describing and revealing who you are. It's not designed to get them to agree with you. What they believe is their job. What you believe is your job. Okay, now I'm just going to go to the next question because I think it leads nicely into this kind of where this topic can go from here. So this person writes, how do I manage differentiation, respect and disrespect, and contempt for the church, for those who have left the church, and for those who stay in the church, and for your spouse? Context: I am the one still in the church, and my wife has left. The most anxious parts of this transition for me relate to my fear that she will come to despise me because I choose to stay in the church. It's a bit irrational, I know, because she's given no indication that this will happen. I overhear some of the ex-Mormon podcasts and other commenters out there, and I often note the disdain and disrespect and contempt, one of Gottman's four horsemen, these people feel for the church and its members. Part of the question is how to manage that anxiety. I know the answer is buried in Schnarch's idea of differentiation and self-soothing, so maybe it is mostly seeing how that might work in practice. On the flip side of that, sometimes in Sunday school and similar discussions, someone will start talking about how everyone they know who has left the church is angry and evil and otherwise showing disdain, disrespect, and contempt for all of the ex-Mormons out there. I want to make sure this contempt does not come anywhere near bleeding into my attitudes towards my wife. We are members of the Marriage on a Tightrope group, and we've talked about how many of the couples questioned in that group are some variation of my believing spouse is angry towards and resentful of the spouse who left. I also find myself sometimes struggling with differentiation relative to the church. I see a lot of pressures both inside the church and from some of those angry ex-Mormons to think that if I'm in the church, I must believe everything it teaches and support everything the leaders say. Of course, that's not true, but I sometimes struggle with communicating that I don't believe something controversial that the church believes or that I disapprove of, the language used by a leader in a talk or something like that. Okay, so again, you can disagree with an idea. You can even be angry about an idea if you think it's destructive to people. Okay, I think that's righteous anger, to put it in that phrase. You can feel strongly about the implication of the meaning of ideas, and you may see how those ideas cause harm. And so to have anger about that can absolutely be an expression of your desire for the good, right? But this is very different than having contempt for a group of people for thinking differently than you do. And we're all guilty of this at times. If someone has contempt for a group of people, it speaks more of them, okay? If you have disdain for the people who think differently than you, it's saying something more about you and your inability to handle other people in a complex world, relating to things differently than you, seeing the world differently than you, okay? And how your only way of handling that difference is to write them off, to just have pure contempt for the person themselves. Now, this is not about you need to agree with them or think like they think, but most of us don't spend the time trying to understand why someone thinks as they think before we've written them off, because it feels much safer to do that. It feels easier to do that. If you can just say, you know, you're only part human, or you're evil, or you're stupid, or whatever it is, right? Then you don't have to actually work through this issue of your own differentiation and getting more solid yourself on who you are and what you think is true. You're not using the invalidation to correct and refine your map of reality. So you're doing yourself a really deep disservice to do that. It's also immature, okay? A lot of people that have left the church, in my opinion, have not shifted themselves developmentally in that process. They say, I reject the church because it's rigid and behavioristic and dogmatic. and then often can leave the church and stay rigid and behavioristic and dogmatic with a new ideology. And it's no more developed. Now, some people do develop in this process of, you know, defining and refining what they believe and who they are. But it's very easy to stay in a demand that the world reinforce your righteous view without really having the humility around your view and the humility to understand the people who think differently than you do and why they do. Now, this is always hard to do because to do it is to disrupt your map. It's at least to question it or to have to scrutinize your map. And it's always uncomfortable and a little scary because we rely on our maps of reality to even understand ourselves. So that's why it's so easy to reject others as a way of getting rid of the ideas or way of thinking or lived experience that challenges our ideas. So yeah, this tendency to just write it off is just, it makes a lot of sense. It's really easy to want to do that because it just allows us the security. Now, it doesn't mean just because, this is what, by the way, Christ was teaching, in my opinion. It's at the core of Christianity to love your way into truth. It's not dogma. It's not ideology that comes first. Love is what comes first, and love shapes ideas. To care about other people. To love is to relate to other people as not a reflection of you, but as another human being, another expression of the divine. This is absolutely hard to do. That's why Christ kept bringing it up and challenging the hypocrisy of a faith, and faith, religious faith, but just ideology that demands that you've gotten it right and other stupid people have gotten it wrong. And you look at our political ideas, it's like extreme rigidity on the extremes, okay? And that's what's dominating our airwaves, is these sort of extreme demanding narrow positions on either end that dehumanize, vilify the other side, and keep us from any meaningful wisdom and ability to care for one another wisely. So while it's human nature to get entrenched in these positions, it's certainly going to destroy us if we can't work our way out of it or destroy our marriages. Somebody says, why marry someone of a different faith if you'll have a problem with not believing the same? Well, a lot of people in this group or in the church have married somebody who did believe the same, right? And then the spouse changes how they think and feel. That's the challenge that a lot of couples are facing. Now, I have some friends and also a sister who married a non-member and dated for a long time to really see, you know, can I really choose this person knowing that they will not believe as I do or want the same things as I do? And both of these cases, a good friend of mine and my sister dated for a long time because they were really trying to work out, can I really, really choose this? That was challenging in and of itself, I think. But for people who are already in the marriage, there's a lot of times a feeling of betrayal, like, hey, you signed on to being a member of the church, living out a certain idea and understanding, and now you're changing your mind 4 kids later, a mortgage, and 20 years in? You know, what the heck? Okay. So the upsetness of that and how disruptive it is. But of course, often the person going through the faith challenge didn't choose it either. It's not like they were, you know, scheming and planning to do this. They themselves come by it honestly and are, you know, struggling to figure out how to proceed in a marriage with an evolving or changing perspective. It's a very different experience to go in knowing versus have it sort of foisted upon you. And, you know, a lot of couples I've worked with, there's a kind of anger at the non-believing spouse, even though they do understand, like, you know, in the case I'm thinking of right now, he didn't do this to ruin my life. He did this because this is what he honestly thinks and feels. This is a honest process for him, even though I disagree with it. So she's like, I know it's irrational to be angry because I don't think he's like doing it to me, but it still feels like he's done something to me. I still feel punishing towards him because he's taking something away from me that it's been really important for me. She says, for many members of the church, The church is a huge part of their lives, absolutely. It is intertwined with so much that they do. So take a spouse that can accept the changing views of their spouse with compassion, but they are considering separation because they want a partner that is more aligned with their same life goals, wants to do similar activities. How do they figure out if that is integrity or just avoiding the challenge of dealing with something that challenges their views? The way I think that you find out, as you know, I'll talk about more in a minute, is that you have to really, you've got to bring enough intimacy to the marriage. That is, to show who you are, to refine the question of what you really desire, to allow knowing and loving your spouse to shape and shift how you think. When John and I got married, we kind of understood each other in many respects. Like, we both had disillusioning experiences and doubts, and yet we both knew we wanted to stay. And then once we got married, we started to polarize some and kind of move into different positions and then fight each other rather than within ourselves. Because I think we both were somewhat ambivalent when we met and got married, but then we did the nice thing of giving each other one side of that debate.
Okay.
When it got a lot better was to just say, look, I'm going to not make it my job to get you to reinforce me, and I'm just going to take more responsibility for myself. And what ended up happening is, as we just became more capable of being who we were, standing in our own position, we ended up just really kind of shaping each other's views. I think we really just kind of came much more into a kind of shared position. Doesn't mean we see the world similarly on every front. But I think that, you know, it just, if you allow yourself to be knowable without trying to change the other person, you open up the possibility of really increasing the intelligence in the couple, being more able to see what you don't see, being more able to see the wisdom that the other person has, as well as having your own wisdom be in that conversation. Collaborative couples are able to bring the best of in themselves and the best in their perspectives to solve things, to create solutions, whether it's in parenting or in life choices and so on. And that is inherently an invalidating process, because you're not just there to get reinforcement or yield to someone else, but actually come up with, through that struggle, what's really wise and what's really important. So to the question of, you know, how do you do that? Well, I think you don't rush out of a marriage until you've gone through that process. Because in the process of letting yourself be knowable and letting the other person's ideas refine your thinking, okay, how is my wife right about this? What is it that she understands that I pretend not to understand, or that I don't like, or is inconvenient? Or what am I afraid of in understanding in my spouse's perspective? Maybe I need to at least understand it before I dismiss it. And at least in my experience, that process inherently evolves your thinking, okay? It gets it wiser at least. It doesn't mean you necessarily agree with them, but it helps you understand better. And so if you're unwilling to subject yourself to that, I mean, you can leave a marriage and go find somebody that's more reinforcing of you. But I think it's a weak move. Now, if you go through that process, and you know what marriage really is you're coming up against a decision. Marriage is going to pressure you. I was working with a couple yesterday. The things that her husband wants around adventure and sexuality are just inconvenient for her. It's not just inconvenient. It scares her. She doesn't want the level of adventure in their lives. She has more anxiety, and I don't mean sexually right now, I'm just talking about in life. She has more anxiety than he does, and he doesn't want to be living according to her fears so much and wants to expand the marriage, and she has tended to want to demand that he yield to her from a more kind of take care of me position and stop pressuring me position. But she has started to change that because she's recognizing that if you really choose to be in a marriage, most of us get married hoping we're locking in somebody that's going to take care of us like a parent, that love us like an intimate partner, and yield to what makes us comfortable, what reinforces us. What you ultimately kind of come up against is a decision of, am I going to just resent and resist this? Or am I going to actually choose this person? Now, in a faith crisis, that's the same question. Like, can I love this person in the way that they operate in the world, even though it doesn't reinforce me, even if nothing changes? Can I really love and value this person and continue to struggle with them around, I don't know if struggle is the right word, but continue to be in an ongoing conversation around how we approach our lives given differences in belief? Now, I'm going to talk about in a minute one of the things that I think kind of infects this question a little bit and interferes with it, which is, I'll just give you a teaser here and then I'll get to it. But like when we, the issue of obedience or kind of yielding as opposed to I see the world this way, right? My faith means a lot to me. I have a strong testimony of this principle, this idea. That's more about self-exposure, self-definition, which is a little different than because the prophet said it, I'm going to do it and I'm not really thinking about it, but my loyalty is to the church, not to you. That's a different position. And if you're saying I can really choose this person in all their difference or not. And sometimes people say, look, I can see who you are. I see what you want, but it's not something I can honestly choose. I can't choose you. I don't want it enough. You want to just know that you're not doing this out of fear or looking for ease or comfort, that you've gone through that process of really knowing who you are, really knowing who your spouse is, to be able to make a wise decision before you go look for somebody more similar to you. Because that process is in and of itself a developmental process, a differentiating process that will help you both take more solid positions within yourselves, but also develop the muscles that allow you more capacity for intimacy with this person or with another. Because as I've become more thoughtful and thorough through more of the tricky stuff, he's gotten more and more frustrated that I'd fight to stay LDS. If I really don't seem to be Mormon enough for me to continue to participate, support, perpetuate in his mind, I'd be able to find the faith practice things that I still strongly stand by in another church over the dogma that he feels is there in the church. Also, there's kids and how he feels they're being taught if they keep going and that they'll down the road end up in the same place he is, but after years of pain and undoing like he's gone through. Okay, good. How do we build a bridge across these differences? What about the idea that we're sharing children and if, you know, my belief is going to do for my spouse, make them afraid that I'm inducting my child into something that will be destructive for them, that was destructive for the unbelieving partner. Okay. So again, I think what it means is you're staying in an ongoing conversation. Some friends of mine where she's devout, he is an atheist, never was LDS. He's part German, the legacy of Nazism and obedience as a framing for him is a non-starter. Like, so any idea that his kids in primary would be being taught obedience, right, is just intolerable for him. And I don't know all of their conversations, but I think a lot of that sort of working out, like, where can we, how can we share a space? And so I know that my friend created much of her own curriculum in primary for her children and would pull them out and teach them the scriptures, but not teach this idea of obedience, but integrity and truthful principles and, you know, how to understand the message of the gospel without some of this ideology of sort of yielding to the system, yielding to the church. So I would say to couples, you stay in a conversation because your spouse has a legitimate fear and your desire to stay has legitimacy as well. What is it that you value in staying or what is it that you're trying to offer to the kids? There's truth in both perspectives. And can you stay in the conversation enough to take what's best from both? Because this will be a great kindness to your kids to take the best in both perspectives. What I've seen some of the couples that I work with do is that they will do, you know, take something like family home evening and they will come up with principles that they can both really believe in and value And let's say they are teaching something like honesty, perseverance, humility, friendship, that they take each week a principle. And then they find stories from the Book of Mormon as much as stories from good literature, that they're drawing on this sort of understanding the wisdom that's in lots of texts around what humanity has to teach us around human values that sustain us, that create joyful living, that there are values that are core to our faith, and they're also understood in the humanities. They're understood through wise thinkers. And so can we give our kids our shared moral framing, work with each other enough to figure out where we can find common ground, and then offer that? Because that's what we hope in the church. If our participation in the church, as Christ said, has any value, it's going to help us know how to love. That's the goal. It's not about locking in some safety or some idea that someone else is going to do the moral thinking for you or keep you safe and protected. You still are a moral actor. You still have full responsibility for the morality of your life, for the implications of your choices. No one can take that away from you. You have your agency. You alone are responsible for it. One of the issues I have with the way we often frame obedience is it's a kind of pretense that we're taking away the responsibility from the person who yields, that the yielding is in and of itself virtuous, and therefore you don't need to worry about it. God loves that. God loves it when you just do things that reinforce him, and you're going to get rewarded later. I think that's immature thinking. I think it's dangerous thinking, because it gives us a pass on the fundamental responsibility we all have to discern and to live according to what is true. And that is a process that refines us and allows us to become wiser and more godly. So I certainly believe that, especially when you're younger, and if you want to hear more of my thinking about this, in January of this year in the Facebook Live, I did a Facebook Live around spiritual development and the stages of spiritual development. And so I talked about the idea that when we start out in our moral development, it's much more obedience frame, more behavioristic, more black and white thinking. We aren't capable of more than that. And when you're young developmentally, you need rules, solid boundaries. You can't jump over that phase. You need that phase to start internalizing the sort of basics of morality. A lot of people get stuck in that and want to stay there forever in this kind of black and white thinking, or like, you know, you do good and you get mansions on the next side, you do bad and you get punished forever. Or just this idea that if you just yield, everything's going to be okay, and those are the people that will be safe. And that's a good place to start, but it's not a good place to land. And a lot of people going through faith crises are not doing something destructive. A lot of people are growing into a more, depending on how wisely you do it, because some people use disillusionment to just jump teams, stay rigid, stay dogmatic, and just do it from a different position. But other people are really trying to grapple with what is really true, what is really good, what creates goodness, what is the truth in this idea, what is the liability of this idea. I want to live truthfully according to true principles, true ideas. So they're growing into deeper integrity and less dependence on a system or on others to reinforce the question of who they are. And that is a scary process often, but it's a very, very valuable process, because it's fundamental to the idea that the truth sets you free. You become less dependent on reinforcement and on others' thinking, not because you're like, I'm doing whatever I want, I've got integrity. It's not flippant. It's very, very honest, and it's earnest. And you've internalized a lot of the ideas that you've been taught to have a deeper, more honest, more robust moral framework within yourself. It allows you the ability to not need reinforcement from your spouse and from the world so much, and to trust your own capacity more, your own ability to think wisely, to discern wisely. So it's a valuable process in our spiritual development. Our theology supports this idea. Even though what we often reinforce in church is a much lower level of thinking, our theology supports that the goal is joy, that the goal is wisdom, that the goal is freedom, not freedom from any constraints, but that living wisely within the constraints that exist in any moral reality. You find the beauty in it. You find the joy in it. You find the freedom to truly be at peace with yourself, with the world, the capacity to know and be known. So we believe in that developmental process as part of why we've come to Earth. But a lot of us take the early framing and say it's all about obedience and being automatons, moral automatons, and just doing what you're told, and God loves that, and God will reward it, and don't think too much because it will break that pattern. And, you know, in the Doctrine and Covenants, it's clear that that is morally lazy, the people that want to be commanded in all things. It looks faithful, but it's rather faithless, actually, because you're looking for a kind of pseudo-security so you don't have to do the work of really grappling with the question of what is truthful, what is good. Cozy Earth sent me some of their amazing bamboo sheets to try out, and I put on these bamboo sheets, and they are truly amazing. And I'm not just saying this, they're like butter. They're like slipping into something that's comfortable and breathes well and really just feels like you're sleeping in a cloud. I put them on the bed about 6 days ago, and both my husband and I were like, wow, these feel amazing. Then I left town and I came back yesterday, forgot all about the sheets, climbed into bed and thought, I love these things. It feels a little bit like I felt when I was a little kid, just that sense of climbing into bed. It felt safe. It felt comforting. And really, I love these sheets. Just like I talked about in the pajamas, there's something in this fabric with bamboo in it that is got a smoothness to it that is really appealing, but also breathable and just very comforting. I absolutely love them. So for the dads, stepdads, grandpas, and every father figure who shows up, this one's for them. Cozy Earth's bamboo sheet set is designed to keep him cool, comfortable, and actually relaxed all summer long. Dad lives here. Head to CozyEarth.com and use my code JFF20 for an exclusive 20% off. That's code JFF20 for an exclusive 20% off. And if you see a post-purchase survey, mention that you heard about Cozy Earth right here. Thanks, everyone.
This person says, sometimes I feel afraid of having a child with my wife since she's not into my LDS faith and I don't know how to handle conflict around the teachings. Yeah, and let me just read this other person's question, which was similar. She says, my husband and I have been in our mixed faith marriage for 2.5 years now. He no longer participates and believes, and I still participate and believe. I'm much more nuanced and progressive compared to before. We're in our early 30s and do not have children yet. We're both very afraid of bringing children into a mixed faith family, and it's to the point that I'm not sure I even want children. I fear I will regret not having them when I'm older, and that if I put off having children any longer, I'll be too old to have a safe pregnancy. How can my husband and I discuss this together and relieve some anxiety of having or not having children in a mixed faith marriage? I mean, again, I think the way to address that anxiety is to walk right into it and to start that invalidating process of knowing your spouse's mind and exposing your own mind. And there's no other way to sort it out than to do that uncomfortable process. Staying at arm's length from it will keep the anxiety high because it's a signal to yourself that it's too scary and too overwhelming. And not dealing with it and having time go by will continue to elevate your anxiety. So there's no getting away from the question. The question will either own you or you'll own the question. So, you know, a lot of life is going right towards the invalidating realities that we're afraid of and facing them so that we can develop our minds in relation to them. And so asking yourselves the question, what do we believe as individuals? What do we share in our belief around? Why do I want to raise my children in the church? Why don't you want to raise your children in the church? is there some way that we can find a way to do it that you would be comfortable, some way to have them be involved in the church that you would feel at peace with? Is there some way to not have them involved that you would feel at peace with? Like, these are not easy questions, but they're fundamental to any honest marriage. Going into that process is going to develop you, even though it will stretch you and it won't be particularly enjoyable. What if the conversations trigger the non-believing spouse? Then they dive back into reading and immersing themselves in the post-LDS world, and their mental health kind of takes a dive because this becomes so forefront in their thoughts and invades so much of the rest of their lives again, and we feel like we're back several years to where the divide and wedge starts to again feel like it might be too big. Okay, well, I'm not big on triggers. I mean, what I think sometimes we do with the whole framing of triggers is kind of give ourselves a pass that I'm too overwhelmed, therefore I don't have to be an adult here and to continue to sort out my marriage and continue to, you can't get married or live life without getting triggered a lot, okay? Like, meaning that things upset you, that things don't go the way you want them to go, that your spouse is making you mad, that their beliefs are inconvenient to you. And that's just part of being awake and alive and figuring out what I fear around the framing of triggering often is basically they're saying, I'm too weak, therefore everybody has to yield to me. So it's a move. It's a way of demanding that people yield to you rather than you manage yourself in the world. Now, if somebody is really coming out of trauma, okay, that's different. If you really have PTSD, that you've come out of an extraordinary situation and you are literally clinically diagnosed with PTSD and getting treated for PTSD, that's different. But the way that one grows out of PTSD is by being subjected to the triggering event until one can handle themselves relative to it. It's not getting rid of the triggering event. Okay, so it's being able to handle yourself in the face of the things that have been hard and keep your mind together is the measure of health. So, okay, I know this isn't a conversation about triggers, but basically, it sounds like your spouse kind of is upset that you won't join him in that and you feel pressured to join him in that. And I think that's a way of having the fulcrum go, you know, towards him and you have to do the heavy lifting and is not really the foundation of a equitable and collaborative marriage. And so my response to that is just that you've got to handle yourself. Like, I mean, I think you both have to handle yourselves, right? But we've got to stay in this to figure out how to be grown up in a complex world where we are different. And what do I need to grow myself up around and to not coddle a spouse who doesn't handle their half? That doesn't mean you're mean to them. You just are staying honest and handling your half without going over and handling half of theirs. Let me just say a little bit about this issue of authority. You know, I think where this can be challenging is, and I don't even know if I have the ability to articulate it yet, but if you have a spouse who's saying, I believe as in my loyalty is to the church, leadership and anything that comes down the pike, as opposed to I believe in this principle. I believe in the importance of my participation here. I believe in the Book of Mormon for these reasons, for these experiences. Okay, that's about you talking about your mind. You're talking about who you are, not a kind of dependency and loyalty outside of yourself. I think that is if one sort of insists on staying in that position. Now, let me talk about the converse side of it, which is, you know, Joseph Smith was not a prophet. This thing did not happen. You get so religiously wedded to an ideology that you're not willing to think about what's the point here. In some ways, what I say is it doesn't matter if you believe the moon is made of cheese. Okay, I may sound really lame to everybody here for a second. If believing in that gives you strength under stress and strain, pressures you to be a better human being, pushes you to have courage, helps you handle your life wisely and kindly and lovingly. I mean, this is really what Christ was teaching. The point of it all is
love.
Okay, not the idea. So the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, right? We're not here to support the ideas and the systems. The systems are there to support our capacity to love one another. And so the truthfulness of the, like, okay, is the moon made of cheese? No, but if you think at it and it actually helps you on some level, what's the harm, right? But if you start going around saying, because it's made of cheese, I get the best cheese. You have to think it's made of cheese. You have to eat cheese. Okay. When you use your beliefs to demand that others yield to you, that's a very different thing. And it's really unloving and it's very much natural man. So I think that this is really important that we think about, are we using our ideas to love? In some ways, I'm not concerned about whether or not someone believes in the church. I'm concerned about how they live. Who is the God that they worship? Because the God you worship is exposed in the way that you make choices, in who you are. I've said to my children, there's not virtue inherently in believing in God. What does the God you believe in expect of you? It can tell you to drive airplanes into buildings and destroy people who think differently than you do. Or it can pressure you to have tremendous moral courage and to do things at your own peril for the benefit of humanity. Okay, so who's the God you believe in? And what does it demand of you? That's the issue. And so getting on high horses around ideology is not what Christ taught. It's not loving. It's fear-based. It's human. But it will always interfere with your wisdom, and it will interfere with peace in your relationships. Okay, just says, my spouse left the church. Now I'm going back to school and also changing the status quo. But my spouse is having a hard time with the cost and necessity of schooling. How do I have courage and expect reciprocal support and acceptance? Well, I think that's really valuable for you to, that's really something that you hold within yourself, that I deserve family resources as much as you do, that I matter also. Now, that's a little different than you necessarily know that right now. So is your husband saying you're not worth it basically ever? Or is it that right now it's too stressful for A, B, and C reasons and it might make more sense in a couple of years, right? Meaning if you're really staying collaborative in any conflict, you're holding your half of the deal. And half of your deal in a marriage is to hold the dignity of your perspective, your honest perspective, to hold the dignity of your well-being, and to keep that in the conversation to be able to create something for both people to thrive. And so a lot of times holding your own is fundamental to doing your part in a marriage. Now, holding your own is not bulldozing, but it might be saying, I'm willing to think about when we do it if you really want to say that right now is not good. I'm willing to think through that with you, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my development. I'm not willing, you know, maybe you have thoughts about the wisdom of what I'm doing, okay, or something else. I'm willing to think about how it's impacting everybody else, but I'm not willing to just back down. I know it's inconvenient to have married a whole other person, but you did, and so I am not going to back away from the importance of my development in this conversation. So that's what it would sound like. I hope that makes sense to you. So it's not like rigid, like we're doing it my way, but I am holding the legitimacy of what I am asking for and what I desire. Yes, our doctrine that this is the only true church feels problematic sometimes because that means everyone else on earth is wrong and deceived. Yes. And I think, you know, I really value what Joseph Smith was saying, what basically truth, wherever it is, we claim it. And we don't have it all. And we've been very clear about that, too, that we can get so rigid in our own views that we undermine our own development. We get too arrogant. We get too rigid in our own position. And so, you know, sometimes what I would say to my kids is, yeah, the idea that we are the true church is kind of our way of saying, this is our best attempt so far. This is where we are currently. In my view, we're only as true as we behave. Okay. And we can talk about, you know, we have the authority of the priesthood. We still only have authority as long as we are acting truthfully within it. That's in our doctrine. And so we can't take refuge in the idea that we're true. We have to earn that status through living and loving truthfully. And that is a group project. We have to always be vigilant about our capacity to live in an honest and loving way, because ideology is cheap. Action is everything. You know, when I work with couples and we talk about ideas, I love ideas. Ideas are so much easier than actually going out and doing hard things that terrify you and stretch you and undermine your sense of security temporarily to give you a more expanded lived experience. But that's what faith is actual behavior. And so that's why love is the most important thing, because love is fundamentally about action. It's loving. It's about doing what is good for humanity. It's about caring for other people. And so our faith must come from that and be an expression. The way we love is an expression of our faith. So those are my thoughts for today. Thanks, everybody. And I will see you all next month.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.